Hello, and welcome back to Music is the Drug, the Cowboy Junkies podcast. I'm Dave Bowler, and I write the biography of Cowboy Junkies, Music is the Drug. We're going back nearly 35 years today to a song from the Trinity Session, the album that put Cowboy Junkies on the international map. One of the biggest songs from that album was Blue Moon Revisited, Song for Elvis, which was released as a single and was a heavy rotation video on MTV back in the day. And yet when the album was initially released on Latent, that song wasn't on it. It looks a pretty weird decision now, as Michael Timmins admits.
Yeah, I know. You know, you sort of look at that. It wasn't because of course, space, right? We didn't, when we originally released Trinity Session, it was on our own label, and CDs weren't really happening at that point. They were just starting, but they weren't as an independent band, we weren't doing them. And so it was vinyl. And I think we put on the cassette. I can't remember. I think we did. But we had to chop. So we had to chop two songs from the vinyl. So Blue Moon, I think maybe even Work on a Building was chopped as well. I can't remember. And those two songs are still in our repertoire, especially Working on a Building. So it's funny, you know, I don't know why we chopped that one. And I can't remember. Probably because it was old. You know, we'd probably been doing it for a long, long time. And it just felt. It didn't feel like part of it, but of course it's a huge part of it.
That song is so much about Al, that bass at the start, and then everything flows from there.
Yeah, the bass just holds that song down. It is the song, and I'm kind of doing the same. I'm kind of copying what the bass is doing, and it's an interesting song. You know, it's very. I would say it's one of our very early, even though it's on our second record. It's probably one of our very first songs we ever wrote together as a band. And even, you know, Margot's the non-Blue Moon part lyrically, which Margot wrote, is again her just jamming in the studio, just singing over top of it. The groove itself is kind of taken from Elvis's version of Blue Moon, that sort of very spacey Sun Records version he does. So we sort of their inspiration comes from that. And it's that sort of our interpretation of it. It's sort of like we interpreted blues songs, you know, we sort of heard them and then interpreted them. And that song, that Elvis's Blue Moon is the direct inspiration for our version. And just trying to get a very spacey and very spooky. And, it was done really as a four piece in our garage, just fooling around with ideas. And Al started that lick. And I think we just kind of fell in line with it.
I think I was at the time just trying to imagine what a 50s doo-wop-y band would play it like when I came up with that. It wasn't much thought to it really. And it just sounded nice. It just rolled nicely. And then, the guitar follows it. And that's what makes it sound nice is the two instruments together doing that. And so that became the song pretty much. That's all we needed.
It's almost sort of a lullaby really, you know, in a way.
Yeah, it is. We treated it as a kind of a love song, which it is. But half of it is kind of different from the other half.
The first half of the song that Al and Anton refers to there features a lyric that Margot Timmins pieced together when the band were rehearsing. Having written several lyrics early on, Margot has pretty much laid down her pen ever since.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't her strength, you know. I mean, she doesn't really take to it, you know. It doesn't come natural to her, and she doesn't want to spend the time doing it. And they fit well with the song, you know. But they are sort of tossed off, you know. She kind of tossed them off, and they work fine, you know. They work fine for what they do. To me, the song is really about the Blue Moon section. It's sort of leading into that, right? So. It's kind of a nice, sort of a nice introduction to that section.
And that section features one of those vocals where Margot opens her mouth and the listener's jaw just drops.
Blue, you saw me standing alone.
it just lay, you know, we just laid the pillow for her to sing, you know, to sit on and or lie her head on and sing, right? So it's the band just sort of sits there and she can sing on top of it. Yeah, it's a beautiful song for her for sure. And live, it's still, you know, that's what it is now. It's still that. It's a great format for her, you know.
And for Pete as well, I mean, you know, he was still a very inexperienced drummer at that point. I mean, what, a couple of years or something? And playing with brushes and with that much restraint, that's not an easy thing to do, is it?
Well, especially now. It's harder from now to restrain himself. Because back then, you know, like a lot of, like all of us in a way, we had our severe, we still do, but we had our severe limitations. And so we did what we could do. So, you know, that's the way Pete kind of played back then, because that's, you know, he, as you say, he was just learning. And it goes back to, you know, the fable, which the true fable, that we had to play quiet in our garage. We had a garage in downtown Toronto, and that was our rehearsal space, and we literally had to sort of keep things down. So he wasn't going to be reefing away on the cymbals with a stick, because it was going to wake up the neighbors. So the brushes was something he used a lot back then, and he still does. So yeah, it was part of just sitting in the groove, and, you know, just trying to propel it along.
The song is subtitled Song for Elvis, but just how important was he to the band when they were growing up?
You know, for me personally, not really. He definitely felt like another generation. You know, I never really thought he was cool. You know, and also I was introduced to him as a child growing up in these hokey movies, right? So he was definitely not cool. But when he tried to be cool again, when he came back, his comeback thing, you know, that just seemed like an old guy trying to be cool again. So I missed missed his whole cool period. And when I did see that stuff, I realized how cool he was back then, of course. Yeah, the music never really did it for me. You know, it was a little too, like I say, of another generation. So, and you know, the soul, the R&B stuff, I wasn't into, that he got into later. So yeah, he wasn't really a factor at all, except as, you know, just a giant superstar.
Yeah, we were too young for the Elvis craze when he was coming up. Obviously, we weren't even, you know, hardly born. And but we discovered him through and later, not even during that, but, like, you know, that special he did, I think it was in 1969, you know, but going back, and, like, we used to watch a lot of VHS tapes of shows like that, and, you know, different shows of blues players, and we had a huge collection in our band house of all these great, you know, late 60s, early 70s TV shows that had music on them. And there used to be a lot of them. And so we discovered him through that and began to realize, my God, this guy was good. And then really began to listen to some, you know, get more deeply into his earlier records and then even some of his later records too. You know, there's some great recordings he did a little later in his life too. So we kind of began to really appreciate him and really appreciate his voice and certainly appreciate his charisma and watching live shows too. Just like, oh my God, this guy, obviously you could see when he was coasting, and then all of a sudden he'd kick it into gear and you go, all right, that's what people are talking about. So, but certainly those Sun records, you know, they're as good as anything that we were listening to as far as blues records were concerned. They fit right in there. So that's a lot of, we were very inspired by those.
Did you go to Graceland when you were doing the station wagon years?
Yeah, we went there on an early tour. We dropped in and we were kind of underwhelmed because we didn't expect it to be so hokey. It's kind of a tiny little house, really. It's trying to be a McMansion, you know? Yeah, and it's just weird. It's got TVs at the dining room table and, you know, guns everywhere and just weird stuff. But, you know, you do feel that, okay, this is where the guy lived. So it's always interesting that way, you know. But it did, you know, it was such a tourist attraction at the time. So it wasn't like walking into a house where somebody lived. It was all done up and like a museum exhibit. And they just tell the weirdest stories about him, like, that aren't flattering at all. The people taking you around, like when he decided one day they had all these fireworks left over from July 4th, and that they would and they invented this game where everybody wore motorcycle helmets and ran around the property firing off these fireworks rockets at each other. And he thought that would be fun. So he made all his, you know, minions do that. And one of them got one of these rockets stuck under his visor and burnt his face. So you know, they're telling, it's basically a horror story. They're telling you as a kind of a cool thing that Elvis did. Very weird. And there's a bunch of other ones like that. And you think, why are they telling us these horrible stories about this guy? They show you the snowmobile that he took the tracks off and he put wheels on so he could drive it up and down his driveway. And that was supposed to be cool, like on the tour. Like, look how cool this thing is. You put wheels on it and drives it up and down the driveway. And you're just thinking, wow, what a nutter. And it's the ugliest looking machine I've ever seen, you know, because it's wrong. It goes on and on like that.
That was sort of a bit of a pilgrimage that we had to do. I think every band does it. I think Spinal Tap made that de rigueur. So we did our Graceland pilgrimage. It was weird, sure. I mean, you know, Elvis is a weird guy. Like, he had a weird life, and he was very, very weird. So it was suitably weird to visit it as well.
Is there a shooting alley where you can blow up televisions or anything?
It probably is now. That's a good idea. They should have that. He should be able to, you know, pay certain amounts of money to shoot things up and drive his cars. And you know, he had all his cars and his gun collections and his badges and his phone. It's just a weird place. And you know, the weirdest part is the people who give you the tours. They're, you know, usually older women who are obviously huge Elvis fans, and so they're totally into into Elvis. And I don't think they realize that a lot of the people there are there for the ironic tour, but they're very straight. And it's kind of a strange thing. Go, wow, this is odd.
Speaking of odd, you'll feel like the odd one out if you don't order your copy of Sharon, the limited edition vinyl release from the band that's out this month and available at cowboyjunkies.com. You can also get a copy of their most recent studio recording, Songs of the Recollection, from there, or from all the usual outlets. The authorised biography, Music is the Drug, is available there too. The Junkies are back on the road with new tour dates coming in all the time, in North America, all over Europe, and in Australia and New Zealand too. Keep checking the website for news of those shows. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast, like it, share it, add reviews, and do all those other social media things, all of which spread the word for us. If you're a Spotify user, you can follow our growing podcast playlist, and all the details of that and everything else is in the show notes. We'll be back again next week with a show dedicated to a very important year in the band's history. We'll see you then.